to this new episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast by RFI English. And this is the first episode of the year, so best wishes to you all. I'm Melissa Shemam, and twice a month, this podcast looks at one major issue on the continent, one country or one idea at a time. This week, we focus on the fight against the exploitation of blood minerals or conflict minerals in Central Africa, especially in the Democratic Republic of Congo or DRC. As the author of the book Conflict Minerals, Inc., Christoph Volger, wrote, the expression conflict minerals is a term given by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development to call minerals sourced from conflict-affected and high-risk areas. These are tantalum, tin, tungsten, and gold, and they're used in high technology such as smartphones, electric batteries, but also in high-tech appliances, cars, and even some wind turbines. These are found in the African Great Lakes region, mostly eastern DRC. To fight this illegal and exploitative trade of such minerals, the NGO Global Witness put into place a transition team a few years ago. It says that in the DRC, rebels occupy mines and trading routes, forcing workers in mines to work for free for a day or sometimes a week, then illegally smuggle the minerals through the neighboring country, Rwanda. These minerals then get exported legally to big tech companies abroad. A report from May 2022, led by Global Witness, found that these minerals end up in products by international brand Apple, but also Intel, Samsung, Nokia, Motorola, and Tesla, to name a few. To try and fight this illegal trade, some companies have started using the traceability scheme, ITSCI, to responsibly source what is often called the 3T for tin, tantalum, and tungsten. But Global Witness has uncovered compelling evidence that this scheme may enable the laundering of minerals from mines controlled by militia and where children work, as well as minerals that have been trafficked and smuggled. Now, since December, a trial may be able to change the situation. The Democratic Republic of Congo has filed a criminal case against European subsidiaries of tech giant Apple, accusing the company of illicitly using blood minerals in its supply chain despite its engagement not to. As the DRC is in the midst of a violent conflict in the eastern province of North and South Kivu, where rebels are using these minerals to support their fight, the authorities in Kinshasa also accused the Rwandan government of supporting the rebels. These complaints filed against Apple are a matter of great public interest, according to the lawyers involved in the case. European countries, consumer and non-governmental organizations are increasing their scrutiny of these international supply chains of mineral, and these extremely successful companies must be made accountable. The complaint could be the first in a long series of targeting technology companies sourcing conflict minerals. To uncover all that is at stake with this trial, we received this week Gregory Mundbu-Salter, a researcher specializing in Africa's political economy and a former consultant on conflict minerals due diligence, to the UN Group of Experts on the DRC.
I am Gregory Mundbu-Salter, a political economy researcher.
First, tell us how you came to work on the issues of what we call conflict minerals, or used to call them blood minerals. What took you to the DRC to do some research there?
Well, I first went to the DRC, or Zaire as it was then, in the mid-80s as a student, and really sort of fell in love with the place. Did a bit of journalism there in 94, 95, just after the Rwanda genocide, and went to the camps in eastern Congo then. But where this story really picks up is in 2007, I came onto the UN Group of Experts on Congo as the finance expert. Then it was kind of clear that minerals were being traded that were profiting armed groups and the Congolese army. Then going to the sort of the provincial capitals of North and South Kivu, and from there traded out by commodity traders to the tin refineries in Malaysia and Thailand and the coltan refineries in China. And we wanted to think what would be the best response to how to deal with this. That's when I came with this idea of that companies should be required to do due diligence on their supply chains to know who they're buying from. Because when I would go and interview the mineral traders in Goma or Bukavu in East Congo, They just say, oh, well, it's Congo, it's hard to know. We don't really know where it's coming from. And that seemed like an inadequate answer that we wanted to address.
I remember 15 years ago seeing the first documentaries on the mines and how these minerals were exploited in very big companies and big trades. Since then, it seems that the situation has only been getting worse because of the context of international production, right? Or interest in batteries and electric cars. So I guess you've followed the evolution. Can we try to summarize for our audience to understand if it's if the problem has been dealt with and we're just making huge progress recently, or if actually things are getting more problematic because of the huge interest in these minerals all over the world?
Okay, so when we made this recommendation on the UN group of experts about due diligence, we never thought this would stop the conflict because the conflict actors, sometimes they were fighting over minerals, but often they were fighting over different things, land usually. They're getting themselves financed in all sorts of ways. They're taxing local markets. They're taxing the local cannabis trade. They're taxing the local charcoal trade. And they're taxing the mineral trade, and sometimes either on the mine site itself or in roadblocks outside it. So, the only supply chain amongst all of those I've just cited that reached out to international to the world was the mineral supply chain. So that was the one we thought we could impact. So that's why we said that the buyers who are outside the country should exercise that due diligence. But we never thought, we never suggested, and we never thought that even if we're entirely successful in stopping financing via that route, that their militias and the army would then run out of money because they'd be taxing all these other sources. So that's been a long-running misunderstanding. Even the US Government Accountability Office, the GAO, last year put out this statement looking at the impact of Dodd-Frank. And saying that, it hadn't reduced conflict. But wow, even at the US level, they still haven't understood it, that we weren't reducing conflict. We were just trying to stop international business financing the conflict, which is a pretty different thing. So that process, I mean, we can go into the industry responses. There is still this tagging and traceability system put in place by the International Tin Association system called ITSCI. There's another one, I think it's called Better Sourcing, similar kind of idea. And it's had some successes and some very well documented failures, but that was never going to stop the conflict. So I don't think it's the success or failure of these processes can be judged on the level of conflict, which is driven by other dynamics. I mean, the geopolitical dynamic of Rwandan military adventurism in East Congo. The fragmentation of the Congolese state in East Congo, the war economies that have developed. These are all processes that can continue regardless, in a way, of whether international buyers are sourcing minerals that have financed conflict or not.
You're listening to Spotlight on Africa with Melissa Shamam on Radio France International.
So maybe I can ask you now, when you read about the Apple case, so this is the government of the DRC accusing one company, and we know other companies are probably buying these minerals. But what was your main reaction? Was it good news? Was it too simplistic? Was it actually something you were expecting?
Well, I think what we have to say about this is that, so what kicked all this off, the whole conflict minerals thing, was really back in 2000, 2001, when the Rwandan army was in East Congo as part of this war that was going on, a regional war that was being played out in Congo. And the army was, I think it was because the IMF was had a program with Rwanda, and Rwanda couldn't have a war on its books. It couldn't show that it was paying for a war. So the instruction went out, I think, that the war should be self-financing. So initially they just looted and took all these mineral stocks they could find. And then as time went on, they became the Rwandan army and its related business ventures became involved in the trade. So that's what kind of started it off. Now, a lot happened since then. We've had the tagging system. That war ended. There have been subsequent rebellions. We won't go through the whole sequence. But what was significant was that when the M23, which is the Rwanda-backed armed group, captured Rubaya. Now, Rubaya is the richest coltan mine in the world, and it's situated in Masisi territory in North Kivu in East Congo. When the M23 captured that, they captured that. Then that coltan that came out of that mine started, as far as we can make out, being exported to Rwanda, where, from what we can make out, it was blended with Rwanda material and then exported. Now, so that took us back to the really classic conflict mineral situation where an anti-government armed group is financing its conflict in part through control of this trade. Now, I guess that the diff what's different from 2000, 2001 is that traceability system I mentioned of ITRI facilitated the laundering of this material because Rwanda is recognized as a country that's not in conflict. So if you can get your minerals across the border into Rwanda and then get them tagged with Rwandan tags, you can, and they do, export it as non-conflict material. So this dynamic of what was going on in Rubaya, this was picked up. The UN group of experts talked about it. Global Witnesses talked about it. And at that point, the whole tech industry, not just Apple, should have, I think, had an opportunity to respond to that circumstance and change their buying, their ways that they were buying accordingly. And I think they were slow off the mark on that. And that left open the way for this lawsuit. Now, I mean, this lawsuit, I should say that prior to the M23 taking Rubaya, armed groups that are on the Congolese government side were profiting from these minerals. And in fact, the Congolese government now calls these armed group Wazalendo, kind of patriotic militia, and is arming them and encouraging them because of the inability of the Congolese army to make much headway against the M23 and the Rwandan army on its own. There's also a Southern African military force and some Romanian mercenaries, I believe. So the case, in a way, is maybe could potentially be seen as a little disingenuous because those minerals previously were funding armed groups, but rather they were funding armed groups that the Congolese government likes. So that's the situation.
So, according to you, the case is just kind of too much of a small way of looking at the entire situation.
Well, the Congolese government is within its rights to bring this case. I mean, I think there's an arguable case that Congolese coltan is being smuggled into Rwanda and is being exported as Rwandan non-conflict material, and that the M23 is benefiting from that. And the M23 is a sanctioned group. It is you're in violation of UN sanctions if you support that group. So the Congolese government is saying that that is what Apple, and I think by extension other buyers, are doing. And let's see how that case gets argued in court, because there is a case for that. Now, I don't have definitive proof, and the Rwandan government is listening. They may pipe up and say this. I don't have definitive proof that these Rubaya minerals are going into Rwanda, but the M23 controls it, and the evidence from witnesses that I've had access to strongly indicates that. So I think as I say, the tech industry should have responded to this. And even deeper than that, Global Witness, I think it was in 2022, published a report which described this ITSCI system as a laundromat and detailed the ways in which the system was unsound. And even then, that was an opportunity for the tech industry to respond. Now, they'll have to speak for themselves about why they didn't or argue that they did. But once it became clear that the ITSCI system could no longer generate a material source via the ITSCI system, could no longer be reliably said to be conflict-free, there was a requirement to do some enhanced due diligence on that. The OECD's due diligence guidance requires end users to take appropriate action when new information comes to light. And in my view, that Global Witness report and the UN Group of Experts reports was new information. It was showing there was a serious issue with this traceability system. Now, ITSCI continually maintained there's nothing wrong with it. and everything's all fine. I think they're struggling to get people to buy that narrative these days. But so that's where I think there was an opportunity to do something else to supplement the use of this traceability system with some enhanced due diligence, commissioning special teams to go look at the issue, for example, or having some customized bespoke due diligence on the area. And I'm not aware that that happened. And I think that's what has left Apple and maybe other companies too subsequently open to these kinds of cases.
Mobile phones, laptops, microwave ovens, and other electrical appliances contain minerals extracted from conflict zone, fueling human exploitation and violence, especially in the Congo. There is no effective obligatory system to trace the origin of this conflict mineral. Such a system is essential to stop the sound of wars, according to NGOs. In 2015, for instance, the Socialist and Democrats group at the European Parliament produced a video to campaign for change that you can hear now.
Do you want to know what's happening? Or would you prefer to remain in the dark? Mobile phones, laptops, microwaves, and other electrical appliances contain minerals extracted from conflict zones, fueling human exploitation and violence. There is no obligatory system to trace the origin of these conflict minerals. Such a system is essential to stop the sounds of war.
But even despite the European efforts to control and clean the trade, little has changed. Here is Gregory Mthembu Salter again.
That after European countries sitting and watching the genocide happen, and in France's case, facilitating it, there was huge guilt and a will for a new Rwanda to succeed. And the Rwandan government has been very successful in cultivating that. And in also has been of late deploying troops in parts of the continent in which Western powers have an interest but don't themselves want to deploy troops. Cabo Delgado in northern Mozambique, in the Central African Republic. So when you do that and you create a kind of dependence on those troops, that does encourage Western countries to pull their punches and not go in too hard because they want that support to continue. So that has helped mute the criticisms. I think in France's case, a desire to try and bring Rwanda back into the Francophonie after years of estrangement is a factor. And also not entirely dissimilarly to Israel, the Rwandan government goes its own way. It does what it does. And it's quite can be pretty challenging to stop that if indeed it's possible at all. So sometimes, particularly the US administration will quietly intervene to try and stop some of the worst excesses. But, you know, Kagame's foreign policy is his, and other countries and other governments might be able to influence it, but they can't stop it. Whether the Congolese government have handled this right, that's another matter. Felix Tshisekedi, the Congolese president, invite in a force from East Africa, which he hoped would combat Rwanda and the M23, and then after a year, he didn't think they'd done enough and rather unceremoniously booted them out. And now we have a Southern African force. It's South Africa, Tanzania and Malawi have contributed troops. And now there, I think the Congolese president was hoping that they would also take an offensive stance and go hard against the M23. But I haven't seen much evidence of a serious offensive action. And then for the UN, I mean, MONUSCO has been deployed in Congo for, well, it must be 20 years by now. And as a kind of a bid for sovereignty, the Congolese government has called on MONUSCO to leave. And in fact, the MONUSCO troops have pulled out of South Kivu. But now then it leaves it open because while they weren't, MONUSCO was not able, has not shown itself able to stop the M23 or defeat them. It has, I think its presence has restrained them. So with them gone from South Kivu now, it may be that we see M23 advances into South Kivu in 2025. I mean, there is really no sign that this conflict is over.
But maybe Last question on the side of Europe, because the Apple case is led in France and Belgium. I guess a lot of the lawyers and a lot of people advocating for this probably just hope that we can raise awareness among maybe European citizens, European buyers. Is there anything that here we can do to put pressure on at least a better understanding of our role in helping good governance in the Congo? Do you think that matter what the European and of course behind that, there's always the American public opinion. Do you think that matters, or is it important just as a matter of principle for the Congolese, or do you think we can achieve anything in that direction? And do you hope more could be done that way?
It definitely matters, and but I just think we shouldn't overstate our agency here. I mean, the EU, when they signed last year this strategic minerals deal with Rwanda, that was an extraordinary thing to do, given what we know about this laundering of minerals through Rwanda. And that was received very, very badly, and understandably so, by the Congolese government. I thought that was an extraordinary step to take. What we want companies to do is do effective due diligence. Now, it seems that this tagging and traceability system has become less and less effective. So we need to have new and more effective ways of doing due diligence, more targeted, more based on investigation and less on sort of rote tagging. And tags don't talk, of course. And I also take the point that's been made by Congolese civil society that there's been a huge amount of money spent by these supply chains on compliance and kind of going through the hoops of showing that they've got a traceability system through these tags. And I think more resources could be directed towards improving conditions in East Congo to help create economic opportunities that would make fewer people feel obliged to join armed groups to make a living. I think the balance between what its companies spend on compliance and what they spend on trying to improve lives is a bit out of whack, and we should look at that too. And that's something consumers can call for too, not just greater compliance, more box ticking, more people to check, more auditors, most of whom are from the West, and that's where the money's going, and redirect some of those resources to improving the situation on the ground. But not easy, of course, during a war. And that's why I say let's not overestimate our agency, and in East Congo, particularly so.
Very, very good points indeed. And no matter how we improve the traceability, you're absolutely right. These people work for very little money and have gained absolutely nothing, if not lost, in terms of living condition from this trade. Well, thank you very, very much for this roundup.
This subject goes forever, so one could continue on and on and on. But I hope we can get to a point where companies focus on effective due diligence rather than compliance, and that they also focus on improving situation as well as complying. And if consumers can get behind that, then that's all to the good.
Thanks again to Gregory Mtumbu-Salter, a researcher specializing in Africa's political economy and a former member of the UN Group of Experts on the DRC. This was the latest episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast produced by RFI English. It was mixed by our sound engineer, Erwan Rome. Thanks, Erwan. Thanks to our guest, and thanks to you for listening. We'll be back soon to comment on more African affairs. In the meantime, you can check our website, rfi.fr/en.